The Old Testament, the book of Judges, chapter 9. I have to admit that encompassing the two chapters, 7 and 8, of Gideon's story a fortnight ago meant that we had too many points, and alas, none sharp enough to be sufficiently memorable. Or so I thought. Sorry for that. The thorough defeat of the Midianites was followed by the complaint of the large tribe of Ephraim that they had been called in too late to exercise only a punishing role, whom Gideon appeased, you remember, by a soft answer that turned away their wrath. But there was also the threat of punishment to the people of Succoth, who refused to refresh Gideon's 300 as they essayed to pursue the Midianites further, which punishment, of course, was duly administered when the 300 returned triumphantly with the captured kings of Midian in train. After these two kings were slain, because, you remember why they were slain? Because they confessed to slaying Gideon's brothers in battle, men with the bearing of princes. After they were slain, we see Israel wanting to appoint Gideon their king and his family as hereditary monarchs, which Gideon nobly refused, you remember, saying that the Lord would rule over Israel, no other but the Lord would rule over Israel. But then, this brave man and a great leader, like so many men in the Old Testament story, who degenerate morally and spiritually in their old age. Gideon sought golden ornaments from the people to fashion an ephod, a kind of standing shirt or tunic, which became an idol and a snare to Gideon and his family. And what a family! 70 sons with the bearing of princes, 70 sons of many wives, and one by a heathen slave woman who was regarded as less than a wife, a kind of Hagar, which made Abimelech think of Ishmael and the Arabs, which made Abimelech, her son, something of an outling, practically illegitimate as far as Israel was concerned, belonging neither to the one side nor the other, because belonging to both. But Abimelech, whatever his origin, had all the drive of an odd man out in such a family. For, of course, inferiority often drives people to extraordinary exploits, doesn't it? So in this story, we need to start here, that although Gideon's father, Joash the Abiezrite, was a Baal worshipper under predominantly Canaan influence in his day, alas, he and his son Gideon appear to have been men of considerable stature. You remember what Gideon said to the kings of Midian when he asked asked them what sort of Israelites they had slain in the battle. And these two kings said, they were men like you, each one with the bearing of a prince. And without hesitation, Gideon said, these were my brothers, these were my brothers. So the family, you see, were obviously outstanding amongst Israelites. God does not choose morons to do his work. Oh no. And in view of subsequent events, Gideon slump into idolatry, and his son Abimelech's murder of 70 brothers, we cannot but recall like a later man of considerable stature who became a miserable failure, Saul, the first king of Israel. Indeed, a case could be made out, as I was hinting earlier, for the eventual failure of almost every ruling leader of Israel. Which, of course, is in striking contrast to the moral and spiritual luster of her prophets. The kings became power-hungry. You remember Lord Acton's famous saying? Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. It was certainly the case with King Saul. And the sad thing with him was that seeing an excellent young man with remarkable gifts, unique gifts we would say, he first sought David's service. But then when young David vied with Saul in prowess and popularity, Saul became his deadly enemy. Because he allowed jealousy to consume him. So, before we go on to look at Abimelech this evening, let us consider why it is that people of the most excellent caliber sooner or later corrupt themselves, because the lust for their power to continue and increase takes hold of them. It is, of course, all due to man's fallenness. There's no mystery about it at all, Lucifer and all that. But the amazing thing is that it is so inveterate in human nature that short of the one remedy, it inevitably ruins any promising life which has an expectancy of fruitful service. And of course the only remedy for lust for power is by the grace of God to see oneself as under a higher power to whom one is responsible. And you remember that Jesus drew this tellingly from the humble centurion when that man forbore to have the Lord enter his house. The centurion said, I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. A most illuminating statement. And he understood, of course, that our Lord was in the same position under his Father. So he understood what our Lord was seeking to do. The only safe power and authority in fallen man is that which acknowledges that it is under authority, that it has a master. This is what we were noting the other Sunday morning when looking at Psalm 124. David, faced with a Philistine invasion, as soon as he had been appointed king over the whole nation, went to the Lord and said, "Shall I go and attack the Philistines? Will you hand them over to me?" And then a second time, when the Philistines routed once came on again, David inquired of the Lord once again, because he was under divine authority. King though he was, there was a king above him. This was, of course, the radical difference between David and Saul. Saul relied on his own judgment, you remember, when the prophet Samuel made him wait his attack on the Philistines until Samuel the prophet came to implore the Lord by sacrifice for victory. But Saul was arrogantly impatient of the Lord's prophet and would not wait to sacrifice, but wantonly took upon him the priestly office. And when Samuel came, the prophet said, "You have acted foolishly. You have not kept the command the Lord your God gave you. If you had," notice this, "if you had, on this one testing occasion, if you had, the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. That would have meant hereditary monarchy. But now," said the prophet, "your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him to be leader of his people because you have not kept the Lord's command." And of course that new man was Saul's servant David, which must have been exceedingly galling. Galling in the extreme to poor Saul, dismissed the Lord's service. What a thing to happen to a promising recruit, isn't it? Now, we have noted the superior bearing of Gideon and his brothers, and Gideon's oldest son appears in a favorable light, you remember, when his father bade him slay the Midianite kings. The record says, when Gideon told his son to slay the kings, he was only a boy and was afraid. Well, he must have been a big boy for his father to suggest, even to suggest that he slay the captured monarchs of Midian. However, in addition to Gideon's 70 sons by many wives, he had this son named Abimelech by a Shechemite woman, a heathen Canaanite. Now, remember the fuss in Jacob's day after Peniel, when a pagan Hivite called Shechem, son of Hamor, violated Jacob's daughter Dinah, and her fool brothers Simeon and Levi were so incensed that they plotted and killed every male of that Shechemite family, Genesis 34. Thus, you see, Abimelech, despite the royal reference in his name, Melech, meaning king, thus Abimelech was despised by his fully Israelite brothers, because in their eyes he was virtually illegitimate. With a Canaanite slave woman for his mother. So he naturally went to his mother's family for comfort. And for more than comfort, the heathen citizens of Shechem were summoned to decide upon the proposal made by Abimelech and backed by his heathen mother's sons, his brothers, that they should not tolerate rule any longer by Gideon's 70 Israelite sons. And so, fortified by their unanimity and their gifts and their support, Abimelech went to Ophrah with the ruffians he had hired and slew all 70 of his half-brothers except the youngest, Jotham, who somehow escaped. An appalling thing to do. And Abimelech became king of the region for 3 years. Nor did Jotham forget it. He went up Mount Gerizim. I think if you've been there, you would understand that the acoustics between the two mountains might be very remarkable. I think they would be. He went up Mount Gerizim, the southwest of these two mountains, the other being Ebal, which formed between them the pass that ran all the way from Jordan to the Mediterranean coast. And up Mount Gerizim, where Samaritans still worship at the top of the mountain, he shouted to the heathen Shechemites his parable of the trees, and then fled for his life for fear of Abimelech. The parable is beautifully formed, isn't it? And tells us more than the historical references do. The olive, you see, and the fig tree, and the vine, all symbols of Israel's fruitfulness, each refused the kingship of Israel because they were too busy producing fruit to seek mere power and authority. And of course, even in our day, sometimes politicians do that. When the rat race becomes too much for them. But the poor thorn bush of Abimelech's inferior origin accepted the kingship, rather seized the power, and then declared to the people, the Shechemites, and to Israel too, if they were listening, come and take refuge under my shade. And if you won't, then let fire come out of the thorn bush and consume you. And having declared his parable, Jotham shouted prophetically, if you think you have acted honorably toward my father Gideon in appointing your Abimelech as king, and then encouraging him to destroy all my father's sons except me, then joy be with you in your Abimelech. But considering all that the region owes to my father for driving out the Midianite horde who were devastating the land, if you have not acted honorably, then let fire indeed come out from Abimelech and consume you, as Abimelech's rabble destroyed my brothers. And then let fire come out from you and consume Abimelech. Now, you see, Jewish rabbis of a later age identified the three trees of the parable with these three judges that we've looked at already, Othniel, Deborah, and Gideon. And although modern scholarship doesn't want to identify the three trees, they cannot refuse the reference to Gideon, who did indeed refuse the kingship, as is recorded in the scriptures. So Jotham, having said his piece, fled. But that state of tyranny under Abimelech didn't last very long, only 3 years. So, see the implied wisdom of Jotham. Having declared the truth to these warlike Shechemites, he disappeared, and doubtless waited. He had only to wait 3 years. This is often the way to deal with a running sore. Denounce it, if you will, and leave it to a higher hand. He did. In fact, there are few biblical cases of divine intervention as direct as this one. Interesting. The great writers, Cervantes, Cicero, Defoe, Daniel Defoe, William Shakespeare, Walter Scott, all suggest that there is honor among thieves, but not among these Shechemite rascals. They became disaffected toward their brother Abimelech, as Jotham predicted. And in came another man whom the Shechemites backed, Gaal. And he, in a drunken stupor, encouraged the Shechemites to get rid of Abimelech, bombastically vowing vengeance on him. But of course, it would take more than brave words to unseat this man Abimelech, wouldn't it? He had the devil's own luck. Yes, that's what I would call it. So Abimelech drove this Gaal and his men out of Shechem and destroyed the place and killed the people. And those surviving ran into a tower, and Abimelech had it burned down with the inhabitants in it. It says 1,000 men and women were burned to death. Then Abimelech went to another place, Thebes, besieged it and took it, and the people there also ran into a tower, locking themselves in, and at least one woman, in fact, most of them seemed to climb to the top. And there this woman found an upper millstone, which she forthwith dropped on Abimelech's head and cracked his skull. And the proud fellow, even mortally wounded and disdaining that he should be killed by a woman, asked his armor-bearer to run him through with his sword. And thus he died. You see, it is no use. You can't get away with anything where our God is concerned. And there is nothing that he does not concern himself with in his own universe. He has control of the lot. We can't escape. He takes his time. And the agents of Satan can do a heck of a lot of damage and spill an awful lot of blood. Tiananmen Square and all that. But retribution is sure, as sure as God is God. And Moscow and the Kremlin know that now. Wonder if Stalin knows it in hell. It's interesting, isn't it? The repeated refusal of some of Israel's excellent sons to be king. You remember, Barak was forced into leadership under Deborah, a woman. And Gideon, with the bearing of a prince, and all his sons likewise, would have none of it. They would not be king. But the upstart, illegitimate Abimelech, he would seize it if he could. At what cost to the people And then, what cost to himself when his seat became uneasy and then impossible? Was it that the time was not ripe for the monarchy then? In the end, of course, we know Israel wanted and demanded a king to be like other folk, which was certainly the wrong reason, since God chose Israel to be absolutely different and distinct from all other people. He didn't want them to be like other people. Indeed, that was God's purpose of evangelism for Israel. You know that? In complete contrast to our Lord's commission to believers to go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature, God's command for Israel to evangelize the world was the very opposite of that. Do you notice that? Israel's mandate was to remain in the land God had given them and live such distinctive lives under the Lord's command that the nations would see and hear and come, as some did, such as the Queen of Sheba and others, to see the glory of the Lord and the kingdom of Israel as it was in David and Solomon's days. And please God, as it will take place again when Christ returns, as Isaiah chapter 60 says. But alas, it was even in David and Solomon's days, illustrious and uniquely gifted as these two men were, it was in David and Solomon's days that the seeds of moral and spiritual dissolution of the nation began to take place through the adulteries of both David and especially Solomon, 1 Kings 11. We're thinking of that this morning in Psalm 127. But you see, all this arose at the time of the judges because Gideon, not content with many Israelite wives, sought a slave woman to lie with of the heathen Canaanites, whom Israel had been commanded to drive out. And he had this son, Abimelech, by her. And this unfaithfulness to God's command concerning adultery was also true of David later on. And according to the times, as far as we can gauge them, this took place when David was spiritually in the wilderness. 1 Kings 27 and 1, but David thought to himself in his many flights from Saul, one of these days I shall be destroyed by the hand of Saul. The best thing I can do, said disillusioned David, the best thing I can do is to escape to the land of the Philistines. What a pathetic utterance. And you see, it was then that, having abandoned himself to the Philistines in flight from Saul, he became entangled with Maacah, daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur, the mother of Absalom, who at last, you remember, unseated his father David from his throne, until God caught Absalom in a thicket to his death, as the woman caught Abimelech, to end an unsavory episode in the judgeships of Israel. You see, what the illicit sexual drive has to answer for in the annals of human history. We know more about it now than ever, by the media too much, alas. The entanglements which ensue, and the attempts of sinners to avoid and even undo or reverse the inexorable consequences of their deeds and prevent the inevitable course of divine justice, these lead, of course, to infinities of futile expedients to hide their sin or excuse it. On the other hand, what peace and prosperity descend upon those whose passions of mind and body are under heavenly control and are directed towards lawfully created activities, and whose lives are therefore filled with contentment to live under God's kindly laws and view them as under divine commission. We were considering this last Sunday morning when we spoke of what we called the red, white, and gold cord of God's triune purpose, threading its unimpeded way through every legitimate activity of life to ensure that it would eventually be packed, that our lives would be eventually packed with eternally acceptable results and rewards. This, you see, is to see our lives as not our own, to do with as we wish, even sporadically, since it is carnal spur-of-the-moment decisions and indulgences which so often ruin lives. One wrong act. Our lives are not ours, but His, to be lived for Him, which of course will lead ultimately to our highest pleasure, if we would see this, as well as to His pleasure. Listening this past week to the story of the downfall of yet another servant of God who in earlier years showed great spiritual promise, one was driven to a new humility before God, lest by inadvertent choices we set in motion trains of circumstances involving others which might lead to the ruin of their lives as well as one's own. O Gideon, that ephod, that golden shirt standing up on its own and becoming an idol, that should lead such a family as yours, every son with the bearing of a prince, to such a pass that their illegitimate brother should massacre the lot of them, with all the succeeding trends and trains of events we have traced in this horrid chapter. Be sure your sin will find you out, whatever you mean by out, for out means out and not in. Out of Christ, even out of His will, and fighting manfully against His will, is bound to lead to disaster and tragedy. You know, my heart is burdened that all who sit here under the sound of the word should get the message. For from time to time we hear of those who start well, but then go off on their own, thinking they know better than God what is good for them. And what a mess they make of a promising life. How deeply sad and heartbreaking when you know such people whom you've loved. Oh God, save our young people here from that. But you see, if we were to dip into our next chapter, we would find that it opens with two men who saved Israel, one for 23 years and the other for 22, and then died, and nothing is recorded of them but that they led Israel for nearly half a century and kept Israel from lapsing into idolatry. Wonderful. We'll maybe meet these chaps on the golden streets one day, shining with the radiant glory of their modest but faithful work for God, without any thought of reward save that of knowing that they were doing God's will. Talk about laying up treasure in heaven. That's what our life should consist of, because, mark this, life which is lived for heavenly gain cannot shut out earthly gain too. I mean, as the hymn says, heaven will come down our souls to greet, and glory crown the mercy seat. Wonderful. That's the way to live and die. God help us.